President Putin has recently launched the Sarmat, a long-range ICBM missile that, according to him, cannot be defeated by any Western interceptors. So the question is going to be, why did he do it now? What is the signal? And where are we going to go from here, especially as the attacks ramp up from the Russian side into the Ukraine side? And now, and more recently, the Ukraine side is successfully striking deeper into Russia. And to try and figure out where all this is going, we went straight to the source here, to Dmitry Polyansky, who is now the Russian permanent representative to the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, where he is now located in Vienna. He was previously the first deputy permanent representative to the United Nations, and we're very glad to have him back with us here on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive. Been a while, Mr. Ambassador. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Daniel. It's a pleasure.
Listen, let's just get right into it, because there's a lot going on. President Putin made a lot of waves here, and that CNN covered this a couple of days ago when he says Putin flexes his muscle with the test of a powerful nuclear-capped missile. And just let me just start off with that. Why this now? And we previously have shown President Putin had made this long statement where he didn't just talk about the Sarmat, but he talked about everything going back to the U.S. withdrawal from the ABM treaty back in the early 2000s and this whole series of new missiles that were developed. And then now then kind of landed on the Sarmat. So what is the message that's intended for the West?
Well, I think those who are surprised with this move, they have very short memory. Because this step was announced a long time ago. I think some people may recall about 10 years ago we made a demonstration of what our plans in the development of missile technologies, and Sarmat was enumerated as one of them. There were also the Kinjal hypersonic missile, there was Burevestnik, there was Poseidon. And now there is a Sarmat. Sarmat was announced, and we are just showing that we are serious people, that we are moving towards the aims that were designated a long time ago. We need to be vigilant because we have to wage a war against NATO, not against Ukraine. Ukraine is just a tool. Ukraine is just a private military company. But it is now quite clear that the whole NATO military bloc, especially its European part, is well behind the Ukrainians, and that it is interested in Ukrainians to continue to fight and to supply them weapons, to sell them weapons, or to supply them, but still for their own benefit. We see that the profits of the military industrial companies are going up. So there are a lot of things happening, and it's very, I would say, short-sighted to try to frame it within the framework of just a Russia-Ukraine case.
And in fact, let's look at that, because for the first part of this year, for the first quarter or so, the action on the front line actually was kind of lower than it had been. A lot of skirmishes along the line of contact, but in terms of any big moves, it was in fact February and March were the least amount of forward momentum by the Russian side since 2023. So it kind of had slowed down, picked back up the pace over the last month or so, but on the ground. But in the air, we've seen some big jumps here lately with Russia hitting over 1,500 drones in a two-day span, the biggest concentration in the war since the war started. But it's not a one-sided deal, because the Ukraine side has now started expanding its strikes into Russia and deeper into Russia, as the military summary here talks about. It's been effective.
At least several drones of the armed forces of Ukraine managed to get the Ryazan oil refinery. And as a result of this attack, we can see a very big black smoke over the city of Ryazan. And here we can see probably 30 seconds after the Ukrainians struck this oil refinery, a big fire. And here we can see the city of Ryazan and the Ryazan oil refinery from another angle. As you can see, as a result of attack, a big fire, huge fire broke out out, and most likely the Ukrainians managed to deal significant damage to this refinery. This is not the first refinery that was attacked and damaged by the Ukrainians since the beginning of this year. The Ukrainians attacked Novorossiysk refineries, the Tuapse refinery, Perm refinery. So since the beginning of this year, the Ukrainians managed to deal significant damage to the Russian refineries through the territory of the Russian Federation. As you can see, the Ukrainians continue doing this, which means that most likely in coming days, we may expect a retaliatory strike from the Russian side.
So what is the position from the Russian side? Because this war has been going on for now. We're rolling into the fifth year. There doesn't seem to be any resolution anywhere on the horizon. But now then the drone wars are picking up in both directions. So what is the Russian side saying?
Well, first of all, there is a very, I think, logical explanation of why there were less intensive strike campaigns previously, because we wanted to give some space for diplomacy. You remember that until recently there were high hopes on these trilateral efforts, Russia, United States, Ukraine, to come to an agreement. And that's why, logically, of course, we diminished the intensification of the hostilities, of attacks, whatsoever. That was not the case, by the way, from Ukrainian side, because Ukrainian side always tried to provoke us, to create some kind of an outcry, because Zelensky right now needs some kind of a big tragedy. He wants something to involve directly countries from NATO, maybe United States, but this is a big price, of course, but maybe some of his neighbors, to get directly into war with Russia, because that's the only way for him to survive and to avoid responsibility for what he did for his country and his countrymen. As far as the attacks you mentioned are concerned, well, it's hard to evaluate the damage because there are very different estimates of this. I read that it doesn't affect very much our oil production and oil export capacities. I think that was Bloomberg who was making such kind of a conclusion. Ukraine was hitting some refineries on the south, in the south of the country. I would say that there were the oil products that were already paid by consumers, including by European consumers, and that they were designated for export. So I think it was another blow for European energy security. And you know that even some of the EU partners, EU sponsors, asked Zelensky to stop hitting Russian refineries, but he proudly said that he denied this request, this suggestion. So he's trying to play the moment, he's trying to portray himself as a master of the situation, but in fact he's not, because we're seeing again that here is another sign of a bigger involvement of NATO countries into this military campaign. You know that some of the bordering countries to Russia, like Baltic states, like Finland, apparently gave their airspace for Ukrainian UAVs, which hit refineries in the north of Russia near St. Petersburg. You know that there is a production of drones and other military equipment that is being relocated from Ukraine for safer locations in European countries, which of course makes them very logical targets for our possible attacks, and we, I think, said it quite openly. So there is a very dangerous slippery slope where we are right now, and nobody knows how it will develop in the future. We address repeatedly warnings, including here at the OSCE, to Western countries, but they now have, because of this pause that we made, because of this space that we wanted to provide to diplomacy, they have some kind of illusion that Russia has become weaker. And I think that now we are about to prove that this is indeed an illusion, and that they don't have any reasons whatsoever to doubt the obvious outcome of this military campaign.
And you say we're about to do something different, that no one should doubt the obvious outcome, as you say. But there are many voices here in Washington, D.C. and throughout the West that say it's obvious that Russia can't do anything. They say, look, we've seen that they haven't gotten in the last 2 years. They've barely gotten any territory and almost nothing here of late. And it's been 4.5 years. This is all they can do. So they can keep nibbling. Sure, they can keep going on, but there'll never be a resolution. So this is basically a frozen conflict. And it'll just perpetuate and Russia will never be able to win. What do you say to that?
This is simply not true. If you analyze the data from the battlefield, you will see that Russian forces are advancing with quite a good pace. This is a different type of war. It's not something that we saw previously, and the warfare is very much different from what the mankind saw before. So we have to be very vigilant, and we also want to save manpower, our manpower, Ukrainian manpower, civilians, of course, we want to spare them. That's why, of course, there is no such all-in-all military advance that some people would suggest we should be doing. You also should take into account the fact that now we face, in Donbas, we face a very significant stronghold of Ukrainian army, which was being prepared for more than 10 years to be kind of a castle, kind of a very important military installation. And of course, it's not the easiest target to capture, but that's what we are doing. And, you know, if you look at the maps, especially those that are being shown by the Ukrainians, you will see that there are still a number of cities, a number of places there colored in Ukrainian colors, which are already a long time ago taken by Russia and liberated by Russia. So this is all military propaganda, and the true specialists, those who do not want to kind of amplify the voice of propagandists, but those who know real military situation, they acknowledge that Russian army advances and Russian army will advance. And at some point, of course, it will create a situation when it will be impossible for Ukrainian army to fight. And there is also a very important factor which is being overlooked by a lot of people who claim to be specialists in this case, maybe deliberately, maybe because they just don't want to notice these facts. But it's the fact that Ukrainians apparently don't want to fight. There is a forced conscription going on in Ukraine. People are being kept caught in the streets and brought to the battlefield against their will. They're being beaten. It is not something that we invented. It is something that is all over Ukrainian social media. Everybody can see this. And of course, the morale is very low. People abandon their positions, and there is a big number of those who left their battlefield positions and who are being looked after by their commanders. So this is a factor which does not exist in our ranks. In Russian army, still the volunteers are fighting. There is no forced conscription. And I think this is a big difference. Everybody who is a more or less specialist will explain to you that the morale and the capacity of army to fight is very important. That's why the sponsors of Zelensky are very anxious about this. That's why they as a precondition for the new for new money that he got, they formulated the intensification of mobilization campaign of forced conscription. Yeah. They also lobby the making a lower threshold for conscripts. Some also say that women also should be brought to the front. So the West is absolutely ready to sacrifice the whole of Ukraine with its citizens. They're not interested in this country. For them, it's just a human buffer between them and Russia.
It does certainly appear that way. Let me ask you a question. I want to go back to something you said a second ago. You were talking about the fact that some Western countries are being used as a staging ground for drones, or whether it's overflights or physical production. And you said that can put us on a slippery slope is the word you use. Now, that is something that I've seen kind of echoed in a couple of other places, which has at least some here in the West alarmed that there may be a change, something potentially different. We had Scott Ritter on our show yesterday talking about Mr. Karaganov, and now he is saying, hey, I have advocated to the Russian government that we should use conventional missiles and strike some of these territories in Ukraine. In the West that have been helping Ukraine. You had Alexander Slatkov. He has called for an atomic bombing. The Karaganov did too. He said if the missiles don't have their, the conventional missiles don't have their deterrent effect, then they should escalate also into the nuclear weapon. And then we see situations like this, like this is in Russian media today. Russia has put on alert orbital anti-satellite systems. Then we have this, not only the firing of the Sarmat, but also that it seems like that there's been more effort in the security Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the SCO countries, that this is something that's it's helping Russia avoid sanctions, et cetera. And in fact, speaking of Scott Ritter, he himself is pretty alarmed because he thinks that because of things that are happening in the West, it is putting the Russian government in a position where it, quote, has to do something.
The problem is now that the attacks that are taking place are doing damage to the Russia's energy infrastructure. That is having a meaningful impact on Russia's economy. It's become a strategic problem for Russia, unsustainable. And so now you've changed the equation. This is the European mistake. They've changed the equation now to make it impossible for Russia not to respond. They've escalated to the point where they've brought real harm to Russia. And so now political decisions become easy to make because you say, if we don't do anything, we are strategically defeated and Russia will not allow itself to be strategically defeated. So the Europeans have made it impossible for Russia not to respond. Mm-hmm. So now the question isn't if Russia will respond. I think the answer is they're going to, but how?
That was a pretty bold statement. So I'd like to hear your statement on that because you talked about a slippery slope and they are hitting deeper into Russia. Is it possible that Russia would actually strike targets in Western Europe?
Well, you know, there are a number of opinions in our discussions. By the way, there are a lot of polar views from specialists, from those who are involved in the decision-making. We have a very vibrant society, unlike claims that are being made that everybody who is speaking out in Russian public sphere is representing Putin's view or whatever. It's absolutely not true. So there are people who are really appealing and requesting that we should strike the decision-making centers. One of them is Mr. Karaganov, his position on the acceptability of usage of tactical nuclear weapons is not something new. It has been there for some time, a couple of years at least, as far as I understand. We have also deputy head of the Security Council, Mr. Medvedev, who usually expresses very radical views. I think it's normal for a society when there are different voices from other places saying sometimes polar things. It's on the one hand. On the other hand, well, I would agree with Scott that Europeans are overplayed this thing a little bit, and they are opening one after another, the so-called Overton windows, if you know what I mean. So yeah, they try to test our resolve. They try to test the threshold where we would respond. And this is a very dangerous game. Again, it seems to us that we are now the only responsible adult player on the in the continent, because everybody else, they try to behave either in a childish or in a foolish way, and absolutely they don't have any responsibility before the societies that they represent. It's not a computer game. It's not a simulation. It's a serious thing. We demonstrate that we have all the means to make our response very painful. That would be really a big, big blow to those who are our adversaries and who insist that they are our adversaries. We leave the doors for diplomacy open. They were open from the outset, and we were repeatedly stating that we prefer a diplomatic way to solve the crisis in and around Ukraine, but nobody wanted to listen. Well, I would say that there is a big public demand right now to do something resolute, to show to our adversaries that Russia is ready to fight, that Russia will not make any concessions on its vital interests. You know, the question right now is not about not so much about the territory, I would say, which some people would say. And territory is a matter only because these regions that are in question are part of Russia according to our constitution, and of course it is logical that we want to have their entirety by military or diplomatic means, which is our preference. The question is how the remainder of Ukraine, the Ukraine that would come out of this conflict, how it will look like, and what will be the norms, what will be the principles of functioning of this society, because it's absolutely out of question that this society will remain in the same nationalistic, neo-Nazi, anti-Russian, Russophobic shape. This is the key issue, and I think that is the question that our European colleagues leave aside. When it comes to the true colors of the Zelensky regime, they just pretend that nothing is happening. They don't think that they need to insist on Ukraine to correct anything. But the fact is that Ukraine is the only country in the world which officially banned another language, the Russian language, despite the provisions of its constitution which guarantee the liberty of choosing Russian language for Russian speakers who represent majority of the population. Still, there is not another country that behaves itself like this. Israel does not is not banning Arabic. Palestine is not banning Hebrew. United States is not banning Persian. Iran is not banning English. I think this is the only country that decided to behave in this way is Ukraine, and this is very emblematic for this regime. Which started its war against Russian-speaking population, which started its Russophobic campaign, and which became a mere tool in the hands of the West. And now we are fighting with the West, and the moment when it will be a direct confrontation with the West is approaching very much, and that's what I'm calling the slippery
slope. Well, and that's actually what I wanted to go down that path. I know we're running low on time, but this is crucial here. Because I have talked to a number of folks in both the United States and in Europe, and certainly have read other public comments. And it is very clear when you look at the arc of this 4+ years of war now, is that there was a lot of concern at the beginning from the West that there could be an escalation, that if we did too much military help to Ukraine, it could cause Russia to potentially expand beyond the borders. And, you know, everything was done. First, it was artillery pieces, and then later it turned into tanks and other armored personnel, then lots of long-range missiles. Every time there was some concern that Russia would do something, they never did, and then it was F-16s. Early in the war, President Biden said, you know what, if it's F-16s, we're not going to do that because that's World War III. Well, you saw years later, they did use F-16s and they put them in and it didn't cause World War III. So now the view is there's literally nothing that Russia, there's no red lines for Russia. They, as long as it stays inside of Ukraine, the West has definitely got a freedom, in my observation, that there's nothing that Russia will ever do. But you're talking again about a slippery slope and a confrontation between East and West. And so therefore, I will ask, is it possible that Russia could at some point change that dynamic and say there is a cost, there is a red line, and we're going to strike something in Europe? Is that possible?
Well, that's exactly the question that many people are asking, and I believe that many people in the West, unfortunately, they confuse our humanity and our desire to avoid devastating moves for the West. They confuse it with weakness, and they say if Russia doesn't react, it's because Russia is weak. No, Russia doesn't react because Russia is humane, because Russia is thinking about the future of the humanity, of those European citizens who will be absolutely devastated by the consequences of this conflict. That's why we're hesitating. It's a serious matter to proceed. But believe me, if it affected really our vital interests, I don't think we will hesitate, and everybody should absolutely remember this. I know that my leadership, my military leadership, has a lot of cards to play still militarily, and if it doesn't use the cards that you mentioned, the means that you mentioned, then there are reasons for this. But I'm absolutely sure that there will be no hesitation, we will not lose time if it comes to the situation when we will have to use what we need to use in such cases. And it's according to our nuclear doctrine. It is open for everybody. Everybody knows in what circumstances these weapons will be used.
Now, I know you're certainly not going to give any military secrets out over our channel here or commit your government to anything, but in the event that the decision makers in Moscow said, all right, that's it, that's gone too far, they they crossed whatever red line is set in the Kremlin, and now that we're going to do something, would we expect to see some sort of, I don't know if it's an ultimatum or something from Moscow that says, all right, if this doesn't change, we're going to do this? Or would it be, no, you're just going to wake up one day and a missile is going to land somewhere, and there won't be any advance warning? How might that happen?
Well, I would just advise everybody I would advise against testing the limits of our patience and the limits of our self-restraint. The fact that NATO is now directly involved in war against Russia by providing airspace to Ukrainian drones, by placing the production of drones, of other warfare in their territory, I think it brings us very, very close to this conflict, which again will have very devastating consequences for European population. And I think that European population is not aware of this. It's being brainwashed, and they are hearing arguments like the ones that you cited, that Russia will never dare use anything against Europe. I wouldn't be so sure, because Europe has used everything against Russia right now. Europe is providing weapons to Ukraine. They provide the missiles that can be used only with the approval and under the control of specialists from the United Kingdom, Great Britain, France, whoever. So I think that they have already crossed all the red lines, and it's a matter of time if it continues like this. And then people will ask questions, so what did we do? Why did Russia respond so harshly and so resolutely? But it will be too late.
Well, that is about as clear as a diplomat can be on something like this. I guess we'll have to wait and see how it's going to work out. I certainly hope that...
Yeah, I just... If I may, just to not to stop at this negative note, because I'm still a diplomat, and I'm not a military member of military squad, so my tool are my words and my force of conviction, as well as many others. So I just think that we still continue to do everything we can in the world through diplomatic forums, in OSCE, at the UN, on other platforms, to win back the sanity of our neighbors. I wouldn't call them partners anymore, and I don't think it's about cooperation that we can speak, but rather about coexistence, and this will be already a very good thing to do. So I'm really appealing to everyone concerned and who has any influence to analyze this situation soberly, and to understand that the fact that Russia is displaying self-restraint doesn't mean that it will continue forever. And I wouldn't advise everybody to test the limits of our flexibility and of our self-restraint. It has limits, and you shouldn't doubt them.
So it sounds to me like if the status quo remains, and if the West writ large continues to do everything it has been doing, thinking that it's impervious to any kind of counteraction, at some point there will be a Russian response across into Europe, as we see. But I guess the last question I would ask is, what would Russia have to see a change? What kind of change could they see that would say, all right, well, now we don't have to look at that path? What would that change look like?
Well, I think that there are two scenarios. One scenario is that we militarily crush Ukraine. I think that this is a very probable scenario, given the factors that I explained to you. And then the West will just have to make some efforts to save what it is, what can be saved out of the Kyiv regime and all these things. The other scenario, which seems very unlikely to me right now, is that the West, and especially European countries, they just return to their senses, and they would understand that they have gone too far and they need to stop, and that there is high time to think about a universal formula of security, indivisible security, that would include Russian interests, because all the proposals from the West, all the moves from the West so far, were made at the expense of Russia, not taking into consideration the concerns of Russia, but at the expense of Russia. And this will not work. If you want a reliable, long-term, sustainable formula of security, first and foremost, European security, this formula should include Russia. I think it's very obvious. So I wouldn't bet very much on the second scenario, because our European neighbors have already shown that they are absolutely detached from reality. But maybe some advances, some kind of developments on the front will sober them up, and maybe we will still see the situation when diplomacy can play a role. So far, I think that nobody listens to diplomats, and frankly, to my big regret, there are no diplomats on European side that are ready to engage, that are ready to do our professional job, what we were trained for, to get together, to find solutions, to propose solutions to our capital. The ones that I face are mere propagandists that are just, you know, sharing the information that their governments are claiming to propagate everywhere. I would like to quote something that I said at yesterday's meeting of the OSCE Permanent Council, when the European neighbors launched another propaganda campaign against Russia, again based on the claims that were abducting Ukrainian children. We asked repeatedly about the facts, but they do not provide facts. They just continue to spread hearsay and to make claims that are not substantiated by anything, and this continues for years. So I just quoted the interview that the former press secretary of Zelensky and very close ally of him, Yulia Mendel, gave to Tucker Carlson a couple of days ago. She said that Zelensky, at some point when he was losing popularity and he assembled all those who are close to him, he said that he needed hundreds of Goebbels talking heads. That was her expression that I used. And I just said that the ones that I'm facing in OSCE right now, the ones that we are facing, unfortunately, in diplomatic forums from European part, they are simply these talking Goebbels heads, because they are spreading absolutely unbelievable propaganda and lies about Russia. So I really hope that they will come to their senses and that they will remember that they are diplomats, and diplomats should listen to each other and should try to inform their capitals in an unbiased way to take very necessary decisions. So far, this is not the case, and this is a source of big frustration for me. But I think I will continue still my job here, and I will try to wake up at least some of my colleagues before it is too late.
Well, yes, that's the hope of all regular people, that diplomats can do their job before it's too late, so that we don't have to get too late. And we appreciate you coming on the show today and spending your time. I know we went a little bit long. I'm grateful for your time, and thank you, Mr. Ambassador.
Thank you, Daniel.
And we will thank you guys, too. Be sure to like and subscribe if you haven't done that. And we'll look forward to seeing you on the next episode of the Daniel Davis Deep Dive. You know, I don't try to talk you into buying gold or tell you how to run your stock portfolio, but there is a way you can help us. Subscribe, hit that like button, and share this with somebody you love.